Well, I'm so glad that we are here today, just to have this conversation. And I'm so glad that it's happening this month, with so much happening in the Asian American community as it relates to COVID and beyond. And then also so much happening, within the African American community. I think this is just a pivotal time to really engage in this conversation in the midst of this to kind of shine a light. So that we can move forward. And one of the things that we're going to discuss here today on this panel is really to kind of share stories and talk about the wounds. What keeps us apart is the Asian American community and the African American community, and how can we best move forward in unity and solidarity? And we know that in effort to do that, we have to kind of go back and we have to look at what are the things that keep us separated, what are the things that keep us apart. And so we're going to share in that conversation today. And because I know everyone's experience and perspective, no groups are monolithic and everybody is engaging differently in their cities. But our experiences are different because I work with so many phenomenal thought leaders in the Asian American space, but I do understand that everybody does not have this unity. And so we really want this, the work that we're doing to really take root and hopefully help educate other people who are doing this interconnected work. And so we have today, we have Suchung Ra is on here and he's going to introduce himself. We have Sheila Wise Rowe and Vivian Mubani. And so we are excited to have all of them here on this call. And so, you guys, I want you to just introduce yourselves right quick, who you are, what you do, and then we can jump into this conversation and add to what I just said, because I didn't have my intro. So, so you can feel free to add to all of that.
Hi, so I'm Sheila Wise Rowe, and I am a counselor, a writer, a speaker. I have worked in ministry in the US and in South Africa around trauma and also reconciliation. Have taught at universities here in the States, as well as the Africa Peace Institute in South Africa. I have recently written the book, Healing Racial Trauma. And this conversation is really a timely one. And I'm excited to be here and to be a part of this. And I think in order to go forward as an African American community, we need each other.
Suchung Ra, I'm on the faculty at North Park Theological Seminary in Chicago, Illinois. My passion for this topic comes from just my experiences and my writing and my research. So for me, the academic work that I've tried to put into this and the writing of the books and the reading and the research has been kind of balanced with the real life work of reconciliation in the church and in my denomination. And just seeing many of these efforts sometimes fall flat. Some do well and some fall flat. But really hoping that these kind of conversations are helpful towards that effort.
Yeah, so good. Thank you, Dr. Rao.
I'm Vivian Mabuni, and I am a writer and a speaker. I've been on staff with CREW for 31 years, and 10 of those years served with EPIC, which is the Asian American Ministry of CREW. So I've been working on working in largely predominantly white spaces and trying to bring about change. I am a strong proponent that representation matters. I'm also the host of the new podcast called Sundays Here for Asian American Women on Ethnic Journey and Leadership. And this week in particular, I have found myself in tears several times just because of Ahmed and again, another senseless murder and this whole COVID-19, the just growing anti-Asian racism, and I think just having to look very closely at our history and how that informs what's going on. I think that COVID-19 has caused the country, it's almost like a boiling up of what exists, and now we're looking at what's really there, and it's very sobering. And so I've found it difficult to sleep, to be honest, and And so here are coming into this place in the space with Asian American Christian Collaborative. I have the highest regard for Be the Bridge in terms of very practical ways that we can try to understand and learn from one another's stories. I think that that's part of our linking of arms. So I'm grateful for this conversation.
So I'm so grateful for you guys to be here, and we're just going to go ahead and get started. And this is a conversation and a partnership, but just really to even model that that unity and interconnectedness between Be the Bridge and the Asian American Christian Collaborative. So I'm so grateful for that. And then we have this representation online. There's been a lot happening. And I think we have to realize this is not happening in silos. So I want us to just kind of just go back a little bit and have you share, Dr. Ra, you can share just some personal stories of wounds and pain from inter-minority racial prejudices between Asian Americans and African Americans. Like, are there any personal stories that you may have around this yourselves, or personal stories that you guys have witnessed, issues in other communities? We want to bring that to the conversation now so we can really talk about that.
Thank you, Tasha. I'll say my experience in these kind of intercultural, interracial relationships in the U.S. in particular goes back to where I grew up. I grew up in an inner city neighborhood in Baltimore that was a mixture of different races. It was about a third Black, a third white, and a third recent immigrant, most of us Korean. We had a common experience, which was all of us were poor. And yet, despite that commonality of our poverty and a commonality of our disenfranchisement because of our poverty, despite that, we didn't get along with each other. And that's something that's kind of bugged me for almost all of my life. There's a commonality of our brokenness. There's a commonality of our struggle. And yet, despite that, the racial categories kept us apart. The racial differences kept us at each other fighting for scraps rather than actually uniting and working together. So that's been a very critical part of my learning and trying to learn about this topic more and more. I've had the benefit, I think, of having these incredible cross-cultural relationships and mentors who have actually helped me to walk through this. As a Korean American, to know some of this story, to read something like James Cone's work, where he really began to see the connection between the blues in African-American culture and then kind of the Han experience in Korean culture, Korean-American culture, and to begin to see these places of connection. I've really had the privilege of having both pastoral and academic mentors who have spurred me on to think in ways that are different. And Sheila Rowe, who's on this call, Sheila and Nick, her husband, have been incredible friends and mentors and guides for me personally. There have been, pastors like Ray and Gloria Hammond in the Boston area, and Larry and Virginia Ward, and Brian Green, just like incredible African American pastors who pastored me through this, and it came out of those really profound relationships. And so those kinds of connections, I think, have been some of the answer for me to get through some of the questions that I started off with. Why can't we get along? Why can't we have a common purpose, vision, life, narrative, vision, direction? Because I didn't see that growing up. But thankfully, I've been in these relationships. I've seen that lived out. I've seen that actually bring folks together and to bring healing because of these relationships.
That's so good. Why do you think, before we move on to the other voices on the panel, why do you think that we are fighting over the scraps, like just the foundation of that? Why do you think, do you feel like we're pitted against each other, or is it because we don't know each other? We don't know the stories. We're blind to the similarities.
Yeah. So I think Andrea Smith, who's one of my academic heroes and intellectual heroes, really puts this well, and says that we oftentimes kind of out of anxiety, out of fear, and justified, we kind of go into our little silos. Mm-hmm. And when we live in these silos, we end up kind of fighting against each other because of that. So for many Asian Americans, we're battling against Orientalism and this kind of othering, this perpetual foreigner. So we gather together in our silos to commiserate together. The anti-blackness in society, racism, and so there's kind of another silo that forms. Sexism, so there's another silo that forms. And what Andrea describes is that sometimes we want to have these oppression Olympics of who is the most oppressed group? How can we, you know, put our agenda first and foremost? But the problem is that all of us, no matter which silo we're in, is under the oppressive umbrella of white male supremacy. So even as we're kind of trying to find the scarce space and to hear, have our voices heard, what we fail to realize is actually we are actually battling this much larger problem. So maybe an example of that would be, especially in this kind of recent case with Ahmaud, the jogger. I mean, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
But there's a deeper story there. The story is that how this individual, who again, not a threat to anybody, who is running through, but what anybody of us would do, jogging through the neighborhood, would be seen through the eyes of, in this case, two white men, and they would determine this person is a threat. And that is something that is unique for African-American men, because the gaze of the white male seeing the black man as a threat is a very common misperception. That's a problem. But the other problem on top of that is that the gaze of the white male had the authority to determine that's how everybody else should view this black man. And therefore, I could attack him because everybody will agree that this person is a threat because I view him as a threat. Yeah. So that is not just a black-white issue at that point. At some priority supremacy that says my should be that person. So when the white male looks upon the black male and sees him as a threat, that white male's gaze can actually be determinative for everybody else. And that works with the white male gaze on the Asian female, the exoticizing and the sexualizing of the Asian female. That's because the white male's gaze determines how everybody else views that individual. So the problem is, yes, this one individual was accosted, lynched, brutalized. But the story behind that is the sense of power to say how the white male views the world is the way everybody else should view the world.
Wow, that's good. That's good. I wanted to really get underneath that to just really help people who are trying to really understand the brokenness and the things that keep us apart. We have to address that. What's the overarching system that's empowering a lot of this? And so I would love for Vivian, you and Sheila to just chime in, to share your personal stories of wounds and pain and inter-minority racial prejudices between Asian Americans and African Americans, your personal experiences. I would love to hear that.
One of the things I want to just piggyback a little bit off of what Sunjee spoke about, this whole notion of, you know, that overarching system and the message that is the wanting to communicate a message that also that you don't belong. You do not belong in this community. You, as a black man, you have no right to actually run through this community. And that how often those kinds of messages are communicated to us as African Americans. And so I had to think about what was the earliest memory that I had where there was a, you know, an inter, say minority racism. And it was, I actually didn't realize it until this morning. I was talking with my husband and he said something that just triggered a memory of when I was in high school, I had this job as a sales clerk at a department store. And it was in Cambridge. And at the time I was living in Dorchester. So it was a big haul to get there. I was raised by a single mom predominantly, so it was really money that we needed. And I remember I was in the cashing out this woman. She came up, it was her and a South Asian woman who was darker than me. and a child. The child was probably about maybe five, might have been a little bit younger. And so as I was bringing up, as I was starting to ring up their thing, their items, the child pointed at me and said, "Nigger, nigger." And I was shocked that this was coming from a child. And I'm looking, I looked at the Indian woman. She kind of looked down, and then the mother started laughing, didn't correct the child. And then they just proceeded to kind of laugh like it was a joke. And I was absolutely stunned. And the message communicated to me was, one, you don't belong here. It was very confusing for me as a high schooler, because in Boston, there really weren't, I think there may have been one or two Asians in our entire school. And so I was very perplexed. Here's this woman, she's darker than me, and the baby's calling me nigger, the white woman's laughing, the Indian woman's laughing. What am I supposed to do with this information? That somehow I am less than the white woman, and I'm also less than the Indian woman. Mm. So that was an early experience, and yeah. One that was a challenge that I've seen played out. And it, you know, Sim Chan talked about this whole defensive othering that happens. It's kind of like, I'm going to side with, you know, power. Whiteness in order for me to succeed. So I'm going to defensively, you know, move away from those who look like me and those who don't look like me, who are, you know, of color. I'm going to distance myself because I want to side with power.
Right. And so therefore putting a lot of times in these spaces, then those groups of people become the enemy of other Black people because of the personal experiences. And so you act out of that and how you treat one another. So Vivian, I would love to hear you on this question.
You know, as I've been thinking about this, there's for me personally, growing up in Colorado with very few people of color, period, what I realize is that I took on what majority culture was communicating. So what is being portrayed in media, in movies, always it was whoever was the bad guy was Black or an Asian sinister, you know, karate person or whatever. But the sense that what was portrayed was true. And there was no, because of a lack of ability to have relationship with anyone else who was actually within proximity in my life, there was no other role models to look to at the time growing up. So I think internalizing that and then realizing that my culture is not one to process emotions very well. I think we tend to just absorb and push through. And this whole term of model minority, which typically is referring to Chinese, Japanese, Korean, not the South Asian, Southeast Asians, but this term was not, was used to pit against African Americans. Like, look, these are also minorities and they're doing well financially. Why can't you just pull yourself up by your bootstraps? So the systemic issues that are there, I think were highlighted. So for me personally, it was growing up and not having friendships with African Americans to understand history. But then I, living here in California during the time when the LA riots took place, I think that this is, you know, it's just some interesting history, but I have a good friend, Christine, who she's Korean American. Her parents owned a gas station during that time. They ended up going bankrupt because of the riots. But basically in 1992, what is considered the most destructive urban riot in U.S. history took place. 60 people were killed, 2,000 were injured, 11,000 were arrested, 2,300 Korean-owned stores were devastated with estimates of property damage over $1 billion. So this tension between Asian and Black, I think in the inner city, again, what Christine was sharing with me was that really it, whoever is communicating information, in this case, what sells type of news, was focusing on the differences, and there's no covering of what was actually going on within the inner city. There were African Americans who were tutoring Korean immigrants to help them with their citizenship tests. Like, those were really beautiful things that were taking place in that community, but it was, the media was really focusing on the differences. And so I think that there are parts that come for me of learning culture and learning history, learning that, you know, in Asian culture, we don't make eye contact. That's rude to do eye contact. Children do not speak up. And so to be around African American culture where there's speaking on top of each other and looking in the eye is important, and there's just misses that are unintentional because of lack of education of differences in culture too. So I'm saying a lot of different things, but I think bottom line is I think that we will perpetuate the narrative that we're taught unless we are exposed to greater stories and relationships that help expand our view on what is really true.
And yeah, that's so good. That is so good. I mean, so much truth in those statements, because if you know, there's so many stories we don't know. And if you're not in that community, you're not hearing the positives. And it's kind of like, because you're brought into the sensationalization of the disparity in the sense and of the divide. And so, you know, when we start talking about challenges and conversations, you know, some of the things that like inhibit like solidarity, like for instance, I'll just give you an example and I want us to kind of talk about, because we kind of just hit on some of this already, but I want us to talk a little bit more about it, like as we move forward in this conversation, some of us, a lot of us, even people of faith have ingested this, you know, because when we start talking about the cultural differences that you just said and how Asian Americans tend not to speak up and culturally, but when we see silence, it's kind of like you're in agreement. And so you're not speaking up because you're in agreement. And so we have to talk about these cultural differences because it sends messages. For example, I saw that Truth Table posted about, I think Michelle and Ray are going to be on their table to talk about the coalition and about the solidarity, the same thing that we're having this conversation with. And I saw someone post, you know, just saying, well, I hope what's going to be a part of that conversation is, you know, everybody using their voice and not being silenced about anti-Blackness. And, you know, and I, and it, you know, and that was the first thing I saw. And I was like, wow, we definitely have to have this conversation, because from my experience, mostly all the Asian Americans that I'm around, that's not the cultural differences that I've engaged with. I'm around some thought leaders, some people who are leading in this. And so that's all I see from my angle, but I know other people are experiencing different things. So can you guys just talk about that a little bit?
I think, Tasha, one of the issues is that how does, you know, even when we look at the whole LA riots, part of that sense of destroying of property, it was because there was a sense of disconnection. There was a sense that these are people that are here pulling from the community for the most part and not really giving to the community. And people were literally on the ground having experiences where they felt maligned, they felt ignored, they basically felt, you know, trampled upon by the Asian Americans who were in the community. And that is what people are responding to, the ways in which they have, you know, whether it's because of defensive othering or the whole notion of model minority or whatever is contributing to that, the reality is that people on a ground level have experienced the consequences of Asian Americans who have bought into those narratives. And it has been destructive to the community. And so there has been a message of anti-Blackness. And so whether it was in the schools, like you can't be friends with those people, you can't play with those people, and all the way through college, where it's like, we're gonna go to the Supreme Court if we have to, because we think, you know, they shouldn't have any level of favoritism. I think that part of the issue is the lack of history, this lack of knowledge that they are, you know, Asians Americans are where they are because of Black Americans. And so it's really important to acknowledge that reality, that people on the ground have experienced anti-Black bias and racism. And that needs to be honestly looked at and repented of.
Yeah, I think that's so good. Go ahead, Dr. Ross.
Yeah, so I would affirm that and say that kind of confession, lament, is extremely essential to any kind of healing, right? So part of it is what we've been talking about, which is Asian Americans, you know, have bought into some of these narratives that have been especially harmful for African Americans. The narrative of, if you work hard enough, you'll make it. You know, the rugged individualism, the right of the dominant culture to mete out justice in a dysfunctional way. Asian Americans have kind of bought into that, and Sheila, you're aware of this in terms of South Africa and your work in South Africa, that the Japanese businessmen who lived in South Africa were created a whole new category for them, the honorary white person. Because they didn't want to be Black or colored or Asian, which usually meant South Asian, Indian. So they created the category of honorary whiteness. And that is something that I think, you know, even if we have not done anything directly as an Asian community, and we have, but to say we bought into that narrative and our desire to become honorary white people has perpetuated that narrative and furthered this kind of injustice. My academic mentor, Willie Jennings, talks about within Christianity, this is also found in that oftentimes salvific viability is determined by our approximation of whiteness. Mm-hmm. And so if Asian Americans have the greatest capacity or the greatest longing to approximate whiteness, then we have bought into that narrative of trying to buy into the existing narrative of white dominance and white supremacy. And for that, we act out of that. And the examples that you gave, Sheila, are examples of a people group operating out of that kind of assumption about, you're trying to approximate whiteness, therefore you need to be on this side of the equation, on this side of the argument. You can't talk about this. And so some of the best ways, and I think, Tasha, you're referencing this, is to present and offer counter narratives, a different way of thinking and acting. A demonstration of those who actually will not buy into these false narratives, a demonstration of what it means to break out of these false narratives. So again, I think what we're seeing is how pervasive and oppressive these narratives are, and the real need to kind of break through these narratives.
Yeah, I think it's important for voices like yourself and so many others to be heard that counter some of the narratives that we're seeing, especially some of the issues that could really speak into some of these issues, and especially as it relates to when we start dealing with affirmative action and in the colleges and all of those things. It's like, we need the Asian American community to raise their voice and remind people of the historical factors. So I think that's, those are some key components of this. It's like, there's like this work of horizontal work that we have to do across together, lock arms together as the African American community and the Asian American community. But then also there's this vertical understanding and deep dive work that has to happen within the Asian American community and also within the African American community. It's kind of like the both and work that has to happen so that the horizontal work can be done. And so Vivian, that's why I love that what you're doing on your podcast, like you're bringing up some of these things and having these conversations vertically so that some of this work can be done horizontally. Dr. Rod, you brought up lament, and you know, and I think we just perfectly segue into that when we start thinking about the LA riots, when we start thinking about, you know, historical factors, and then there's so many other things, like you brought up the issue in South Africa, and then someone even brought up some issues between Asian Americans in Uganda that I had no idea about that particular history, but you brought up lament, and I know you wrote the book that I always recommend, Prophetic Lament, and I think Sheila quotes it in her book. I quote you in my book. I use when I do my trainings. I use your quote on. One particular quote I use when we're talking about culture, you know, and really pointing to people how we have to look to thought leaders that that are, you know, that look different from us as it relates to leaders in our community. Why is this important in the context of prejudices and pains between our community? Why is lament important for this conversation to move forward for us to really understand what true solidarity looks like and really keep that in the forefront?
Yeah, so what I appreciate about the language of lament, of course, is that it's a biblical language, right? I mean, it's the proper, appropriate response of God's people to the reality of suffering in the world. And that's why in the scriptures you see so much lament, because oftentimes people are suffering. And Israel, God's people in the Old Testament, praised God 60% of the time, but 40% of the time they lamented. And I think one of the things about this kind of solidarity is that we can lament with each other. And I go back to James Cone's work that says that one of the things, and he was writing right at the height of the tension. He's in New York, and he's seeing the tension in New York between African American in the community and Korean shopkeepers. He's seeing that, and he's actually trying to point out there's actually a commonality there, that the blues that express this lament, this kind of corporate lament that comes out of the African American community, that kind of blues and lament are also found in the Korean community, which has experienced a lot of suffering as well. So I think one of the things that we struggle with when we kind of deal with intercultural, interracial, is that we want to celebrate our successes over and against the other, right? So we say, hey, look at all the Asians in Ivy League schools, and they should hang out with the Blacks from the Ivy League schools. And what we end up doing is kind of celebrating the successes mostly by the ways we've succeeded in majority culture. But I think what lament calls us to is actually to find a commonality of our suffering, a commonality of our brokenness. And that all of us, because of this oppressive systems and oppressive narratives, have suffered. And I would even include in that white Americans have also suffered. The trauma, and this is Mark Charles and I's latest book, that there is a trauma that white people have suffered because these narratives of white supremacy haven't helped them either. We saw this in the 2016 election, where marginalized white Americans had nowhere to go. They had nowhere to turn because they realized that this narrative wasn't working for them either, of white supremacy. And even more so, the commonality of Asians who in some sense have flourished, and not in others, but some have flourished in this white supremacy, to actually say, no, there's a commonality here, there's a brokenness. And it requires lament. And that's where I think hearing each other's stories, the story of the civil rights movement, the story of the slave trade, and for in the other way, to hear the story of internment, the story of abuse of Chinese laborers, the story of Korean comfort women, the Cambodian genocide. Those are things that are stories that we share, and that our commonality is not in, hey, look, we all won and are victorious and we're great people now. versus actually the most common denominator for all of us is probably suffering, is probably lament.
Sheila, you write a lot about healing racial trauma. You say it's not enough for us to pursue healing. We need to also become resilient in this. Can you talk a little bit about what it means to find healing in racial pains and how to take those next steps into resilience? What does that look like?
The first step, I think, is a lot of what we've talked about in terms of our stories, and that oftentimes we spend a lot of energy running away from our story, mm-hmm. of not facing it head on. And so whether it's our history and how racism has affected us over generations, or even, you know, currently interpersonally, or what is happening in society, and that stopping to actually look at it, not medicate, not run away from it, but to honestly look at it and to, and I partner this with lament, as Sun Chen spoke about, that sense of coming together with others who can see and acknowledge and validate the pain and the suffering that that has occurred. Like that really is the first step in terms of healing, is because so often we're getting messages that it's not, like, which, you know, you made this up, it's not that bad. And we get it from the outside and we get it from the inside too. Mm-hmm. We minimize. And so a consequence of that is that we're feeling it in our bodies, our minds. This, what are we in week seven has exposed, you know, what the little thin veneer, wow. that, you know, that we're, that everything is okay. Everything is not okay. It's right. not. And that everything from the economy and who's actually working and who's essential, who gets healthcare, who gets the test, who gets a ventilator, who gets to jog, mm-hmm. you know, the veneer is gone. And so we're seeing the truth of that matter. And right. so what do we do with that? Lamenting and prayer is definitely a part of that. And another huge part of it is, what are we going to do about it? Right. You know, what are we going to do about what we see? Mm-hmm. And I feel like some of the conversations that I'm seeing right now is a lot of, I'm sorry. And you know what? I'm beyond sorry. I'm sorry. I want to know, what are you going to do? Be sorry. I get that. I get that empathy and the connection, but what are you going to do about what it is that you've seen?
Yeah.
Because you can't unsee what you saw.
Right.
And so I, you know, building resilience really is one of, how do we, as Black people, as people of color, bounce back in a way that we're stronger? And that really is going to require our dealing with what is happening. You know, if we're triggered, figuring out what is that trigger trying to teach us? Mm-hmm. That trigger may be a teacher in disguise, and it's saying something. It's saying either there's some internal work that needs to be done, there's stuff that externally you need to be doing, but we've got to pay attention, and we've got to look at our whole life holistically, like every part of our life, in terms of building resilience. Like how can I put things in place that are going to see me through? Because racism is not going to end anytime soon. And so in order to survive and to thrive, we've got to be really intentional about taking care of our soul, because no one else is going to do it for us.
Yeah. Because it's not going to go away when it's not a headline. It's not going to go away when there's a, you know, a vaccine for COVID-19. Yeah. It's just going to reinvent itself in another way. These issues, this is illuminating a lot of issues in how people see, you know, marginalized groups. And I mean, I personally, you know, 1 week we're talking about the numbers and the vulnerable populations this is impacting. And, you know, and then the next week we're ready to open. And it's just kind of like when we're looking at that data and what our society is saying is all lives don't matter, that, you know, some lives are expendable. And I was just looking at, you know, I think it was one of the meat packing plants in the Dakotas, where a lot of the people who work in those are Asian Americans, and Native Americans, and Latina Americans. And it's like, and it just depends on where you are in this country. In North Carolina, a lot of those people in the meat plaque in Smithfield, you're going to find Latina and African-Americans that are working in those plants. And it depends on where you are, but those are those vulnerable populations that are suffering. So I think this is important for us to remember, is that this doesn't go away. Racism doesn't go away when the headline is not there. It's like we have to keep continuing to engage in this, even when it's not in the headline, even when people are not thinking about it, we have to keep talking about it. Vivian, how do we begin to reconcile with one another? You know, when we start talking about this path toward racial healing, this path towards reconciliation, where do we find this mapped out in scripture, first of all, and how can Asian Americans and African Americans kind of pursue this together? I think we, you know, Dr. Rao talked about the lament factor. You know, Sheila's talking about really identifying the racial trauma, really digging underneath some of the issues. We have to talk about some of these main issues, underlying issues that keep us separate, and really make sure that we're not trying to conceal these things from one another, but we have to have some real talk around these, some hard discussions around this. How do we move forward into this path of reconciliation?
I think that it really begins with confession and admitting. And I think it's right to the core of our pride, being able to speak out exactly what is true, that beginning with me, you know, I have believed a wrong narrative about African Americans in this country, and have not spoken up and have not corrected when confronted with racist comments about any other group, even my own. You know, just I think it begins with the humility of admitting. And I heard a really inspiring story of a revival that took place in Korea, but they traced some of it to a Canadian medical missionary who was white, who came and confessed that he felt superiority over the Koreans. And you know, as a result, the Koreans were confessing their hatreds towards the Japanese, you know, and there's just this genuine humility that comes with being able to bring into the light and allow God's spirit to illuminate and convict us of our sin. I think that when that is taking place and our hearts are being transformed, then this whole body of Christ is we're not siloed. We are, when one part of the body is suffering, we are all suffering. And so I feel that very significantly, because now that my relationships have expanded to include some incredible African-American brothers and sisters, Tasha, you included, it's like there is a genuine lament and sorrow when my brothers and sisters are suffering in a community. When I know personally people who were just driving home and they're getting pulled over and because they're Black, you know, it just, those kinds of realities all of a sudden become my own, because now there's real people, real relationships, and real repentance, and really be able to call those things out. So I think the scriptures are pretty clear in terms of us. We cannot separate. Justice is not a political issue. It is gospel, scriptural from beginning to end. And I think that that's where seeking the Lord and seeking His Spirit to illuminate and to do exactly what Jesus says, the Holy Spirit is the one to convict us of our sin and our need for Him. I think that that's where it begins. And I would love to actually hear more from Sheila and Sujan too with these thoughts.
Yeah, can you guys chime in on there, and we'll kind of close out with this question, because I think this really takes us into that next step of us having true kingdom solidarity. So I'd like to have Dr. Ra comment, and then Sheila have the closing statement on that.
Yeah, I think solidarity is a really important word here. And solidarity does not imply just kind of a simple tacit affirmation of the other. It really goes much deeper than that. It is walking alongside. And so for that, it's kind of the depth of that word is beginning to end. The lament that is required to say, yeah, we're in the same, you know, mess together. I'm experiencing differently as an Asian American man, but, you know, we're still under this oppression. We're still under this ridiculously sinful oppression. And then how can I join in that lament alongside? But the thing about solidarity is not just that moment of experiencing lament together, which I think is a good place to go, but it's also now that I know that we are in this together, what can I do that will actually put myself in that place as well? Some of that might be, what privileges do I give up because I have chosen to practice solidarity? Some of it could be, what are the places I'm putting myself in the line of fire? Because maybe I have a voice that others do not. I mean, as a professor, as a writer, I have a voice that others do not. How much am I willing to use that privilege, that to practice solidarity? So I think that I really appreciate this language around solidarity, because what it gives us is a much deeper plan going forward. It's not simply, I like you, you like me, let's join hands and sing kumbaya. No, we feel the depth of each other's pain, and then we move towards, if you are really my brother and my sister, then how do I put my life on the line for you, and vice versa? How do I put all my privileges and all my benefits on the line for you? Because that is what it means to practice solidarity together.
That's good.
One of the things that comes to mind is Miroslav Volk talks about beyond just repentance and forgiveness, that the next step is repair. And that there needs to be a commitment in terms of, if we're going to have solidarity, we've got to look at the repair that needs to happen. How have we damaged one another? You've spoken about just the whole notion of where my places of privilege that I can then use that to open doors for access, for healing, for one another. I think across the board, we, whether we're African American or whether we're Asian American, yes, we have to look at our stuff. There has to be a level of repentance and forgiveness. But then the next step is walking that out in a very intentional way. The Asian American Christian Coalition and just the tenets and things that you wrote out, I was impressed by, and because I felt like it was very comprehensive and it really was addressing the systemic issues and our interrelationships. And that's really crucial. If we're gonna have any inroads in terms of overcoming the systemic racism that's so prevalent in our society, we've got to look at how do we have that embedded in us so that we're rooting out that evil in us. And then how are we going to attack that in society at large? And so we've got to figure out what are the joint actions that we can take together to, and whether that is supporting one another on an emotional level, walking through with trauma and in prayer, but also in terms of action, that it has to be more than just a hashtag.
Yeah.
It has to move to a place where we're actually standing up together. And we've seen that. We saw that with Dr. King. We saw mass action actually shifting this country. And that's what needs to happen. There needs to be, yes, lots and lots and lots of prayer. And there needs to be action. It's our faith and works together. And so I'm going to leave it at that. But that's my hope that will come out of these kinds of conversations.
Yeah, let's give, as people who are listening, maybe for some people who are listening, maybe they haven't done the deep dive into this, and this is their first time even ever thinking about it. They haven't begun to really dig up, okay, where is this narrative coming from? Where is this bias coming from? Where is this stereotype? So people, as they're hearing this, this is probably coming to mind. when we think about giving someone's where to start as it relates to action, let's give one action of beyond prayer. So because prayer is an action. So we got the prayer, okay? let's give one action that people can do beyond this conversation to start today.
I think to learn the story of the other, we've already been talking about, to kind of join in that common lament would be kind of a very important first step, because I would hate for people to jump in without knowing how deep the water is,
right,
and how deep this goes. So developing relationships, reading the text, taking a class, I think just getting to know the history and how deep this goes, because I think some of us, when we speak without knowing the depth, we end up actually maybe even being counterproductive in our thoughts.
Yes, I would encourage everyone to expand your reading. Follow people on Twitter from different viewpoints and ethnic cultural backgrounds. I think we tend to, even as believers, have a very narrow European-centric theology even, and I think we need to expand beyond that as well and read widely and take in other sources, not be so locked into what we think is the only way, which is very narrow, but actually expand our news sources, expand even outside of the United States, I think is helpful too, and for us to really become more robust in our intake. I think that would be a good next step.
Yeah. Okay. And Sheila.
I think that because we are constantly bombarded by traumatic incidents, like one after the other, mm-hmm. Whether it's the racism that's targeting African-American men, women, children, whether it's the Asian-American attacks that have happened in the middle of this COVID crisis. And so it's causing these emotions to stir in people. And so they're having strong emotions. People who may not have even, they've been kind of clueless. And yet there's something being stirred to pay attention to that. Mm-hmm. And then to look at what is going on out there that I can join in helping to support. Yeah. And so whether it's supporting on an emotional level, or I need to sign a petition, or I need to call my congressman, what do I need to do? Do I need to go and like make sure, okay, you know what, I'm gonna go door to door once this is over and make sure people are registered to vote. What am I going to do? And so you're getting triggered, you're feeling some kind of way, don't stop there. Right. Please look around. That information is everywhere. It's all over the internet on ways in which you can join in.
Yeah.
And join in.
And there's so many organizations, like it's good to be a part of this collaboration, Be the Bridge and Truth Table and The Witness, like all these organizations that are out there that are giving constantly on the front lines of these conversations, even when it's not a hashtag, when it's not a headline, helping people as it relates to racial literacy, helping people to do the work of anti-racism. And I think that's key, is to be a part of these groups and in these conversations. Even when it's not happening to you, when when it's not a hashtag, to be on the front lines of all of this injustice and racial disparities, so that you're aware. The same thing, I was just telling some people just about the our Indigenous community this week. I think it was May the 4th was. Missing and murdered Indigenous Women Day, and acknowledgement and remembering that. And so even if like that's happening, like when we think about this is happening in a lot of groups, when you are a person of color and you go missing, how you are searched for, it looks different. There's a racial disparity in that. And so even if the numbers are not like that in every group, we still have to pay attention, because we have to remember, and MLK says this, and it's so true, is that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And it's kind of like that thing where it may not be happening to you or your people right now, but it will. And so you have to understand how these systems work and how they play. And so I think it's important for us to really lean into this conversation and not and put action to our words. And so us, you know, getting up close and lamenting these historical factors that divide us, that separate us, that tell us lies, to really confessing those things, and then dealing with the trauma that this has caused, and then looking in ways, how can we heal and move forward in restoration and justice together and with action. So this is just the beginning. We cannot do everything on an hour panel discussion. This only thing we did was begin to scratch the surface just a little bit. You know, there's a deeper dive that has to happen, and that's going to have to happen in the personal work. This work of reconciliation is not a checkbox that you check, but it's a lifestyle that you live and commit to in every breath that you take. And so I would encourage you guys all to continue this path, continue this work, dig deep, even when it's uncomfortable, even when it's painful, even when you get embarrassed, you know, you got to keep coming back and really digging deep so that we can have a world and a community, not where just some are flourishing, but all are able to flourish. And that's what reconciliation is about. So thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us in this conversation. Remember, this is just the tip of the iceberg of a much deeper conversation that we need to have, but we're starting someplace. We're starting somewhere today. And so I'm grateful for you.